Hello and welcome to the Food Connections podcast, a podcast that connects you with the food you eat. I'm Dr. Laura Wyness, a registered nutritionist who grew up wearing wellies and helping out on my family's farm in Aberdeenshire. I think it's so important to know where our food comes from and how it's made. And what better way than to hear directly from the individuals involved in making our food? In this episode, I'm joined by Bryce Cunningham, farmer and managing director of Mossgiel Organic Farm in Ayrshire, about 30 miles south of Glasgow. Although dairy farming was not initially part of Bryce's career path, when the milk price collapsed in 2015 and bankrupted the family farm, Bryce felt there must be a better way of doing dairy farming, one that works for farmers, for animals, and for the people drinking the milk. Mossgiel is building a new model of dairy farming, producing, processing, and delivering organic milk in a sustainable way that supports local business and, of course, provides a healthy and tasty milk for people to drink. I've been following Mossgiel's story over recent years, and it's been amazing to see all their innovations, their collaborations, and their growth. Just recently, Mossgiel has expanded their deliveries so that you can now get their milk not only in Scotland, but also in London and many other places nationwide. Check out the show notes for details of this. I hope you enjoy listening to this episode. Okay, welcome to the Food Connections podcast. I am so excited today to have Bryce Cunningham on the podcast finally as a guest. I know you're extremely busy, Bryce, and judging from your social media recently, it looks like you've been even more busy, if that's possible, with some very exciting developments, which we'll come on to in a moment. But I wondered if you could start off, for anyone who hasn't been following you on social media or following your story, can you start by kind of sharing a little bit about your background and how you started in dairy farming?
Yeah, of course. Thanks very much for having me on. So I'm a third generation dairy farmer here at Mossgiel Farm, and was born at the farm here. But when I was growing up, I actually had no interest whatsoever in farming. In fact, when I got to leaving school age, I had a big fight with my dad where I turned around to him and said I wasn't standing underneath the backside of a cow the rest of my life. And I went off to work with the motor trade. So I worked with Mercedes-Benz for my first 10 years of my career. So I started off as a mechanic and ultimately ended up in sort of lower level management in the motor trade. While I was with Mercedes-Benz, I actually learned an awful lot about the stuff that I'm doing today. So I went to Germany a couple of times and I was blown away by the recycling culture and, you know, their whole attitude towards waste. So in the garage in Mercedes-Benz here, everything went in a big skip, and if it was metal, it went to a different skip. In Germany, there was a car park full of different types of skip. You get your backside kicked if you put it in the wrong skip at the time. I also noticed that organic agriculture was quite big over there. There was organic only supermarkets kicking about. And at the time, I never really thought much of it. I just thought it's different, and that was it. When I was 26, 27, we discovered that my dad had terminal cancer, and my other business partner, my grandpa, he also had a terminal heart condition and an early onset dementia. And when we discovered that, that was when I kind of thought, right, I'm going to leave my job, I'm going to go back to the farm, and however long it takes to sort of sail off the herd and for the family to leave the farm, that's what we'll do. And then I came back, and within a short period of time, I thought, actually, you know, I want to give this a go. I want to see what I'm missing from farming. And my grandpa, he died a couple of months after I sort of made that decision, and my dad a year later. But the same month my dad died, the milk price collapsed. And we basically went from being paid 27 pence per litre down to 9 pence per litre, which bankrupted the farm. So by this time, I was sitting there going, I could go back to Mercedes-Benz, farming isn't really working, but the whole time I was doing this, I kept thinking about my time spent in Germany, about this whole sort of, this organic focus and how farms seem to be much smaller over there, and although they had a lot of pressures, there just seemed to be a bit of a different sort of culture to food and into farming and attitudes there, and I thought to myself, right, I'm going to give this a bit of a go, and the farm's bankrupt anyway, so effectively nothing to lose, so I wanted to pasteurise my own milk and sell it to the local community, and I wanted to do other things with farming that I didn't have the opportunity to do when Dad and Papa were there. So we became organic and wanted to sell milk direct, as I say, but in Scotland you have to pasteurise milk, you can't sell it raw, and I couldn't really afford a pasteuriser because no bank in the country was going to give us any money, and I had no savings left from Mercedes. I managed to scramble enough funds together to buy an old stainless steel yogurt maker, and I modified it, but with my knowledge of welding from my mechanic days, to be able to make this milk pasteuriser. And my whole idea was I wanted to make the milk taste and behave like raw milk, but actually be pasteurised so I could sell it legally. Because I remember that when I was with Mercedes, I was drinking milk from the supermarket and I really didn't enjoy it. I'd actually stopped taking it in coffee and I didn't really eat cereal anymore. And then when I came back to the farm, I was finding myself eating 4 and 5 bowls of cereal with the milk, and coffee tasted better. And I thought, that's in the milk. And I started doing a lot of research into why milk tasted the way it did, and the whole reason that our farm was about to go bankrupt. And it all seemed to link itself in together of a total attitude and culture change away from what I perceive as real food and sort of raw food culture, if you like, into this sort of convenience-driven world where price is number one. Supermarkets are using price as a way to get people through the door as a marketing trick. And unless it's in a plastic bottle or very convenient for you to use, the supermarkets don't want it. So people had then migrated into a different food system, not driven by health and by nature and by sort of sustainability, but in fact driven by convenience and price. And as I say, that was 10 years ago. Over the past 10 years, we've really challenged how we can operate as a business. We've scaled up this unique way of pasteurising that we created that allows milk to taste and behave like raw milk but still be pasteurised. We're now supplying it UK wide. We're supporting 3 other Scottish organic family farms by buying their milk. So the business has definitely scaled up, and we're doing it all in such a way that it's fully organic and we don't use any single-use plastic in our packaging. So again, going back to that whole learning I had in Germany. So
I wonder, can you, I guess, paint the picture, first of all, like Mosgiel Dairy Farm, where is it located? What it looks like today, just to give kind of listeners an idea.
We're a 200-acre dairy farm, a grass-based dairy farm. We don't grow any crops. We're in the southwest of Scotland in a village called Mochlin, which is about 25 miles from Glasgow. And yeah, so it's a typical Ayrshire farm. It rains too much and I moan about it too much. And we really love days like today for the sun's out, but we don't get them often enough.
Is there a lot of dairies in that area of Scotland, or is it more crops?
Yeah, no, the southwest of Scotland is the sort of dairy heart of Scotland. So we're probably sort of near the top of it. The kind of main amount of dairy farms are kind of down Dumfries and Galloway area. Yeah, so Ayrshire and Dumfries and Galloway, that kind of corner of Scotland is where most of the dairy happens.
And of course, Robbie Burns as well lived on your farm back in the day. I'm not sure what day is it, 1700 something?
So between 1784 to 1786.
That's obviously impacted your business, or does it impact your day-to-day work or business much?
On a day-to-day basis, I don't think Robert Burns being here really sells much milk for us. But again, digging back into, I'm a little bit of a Burns fan. I'm certainly not the number one Burns fan in the world, but digging back into some of the challenges he had, but also some of the realisations he had at the time, I find myself quite often thinking about some of the lines he wrote. For example, like, "I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union." That was him talking about how his plough hit a mouse's nest and the impact of humankind and farming on the environment was significant enough to sort of knock this mouse's nest away. He was talking about the wider issues in society and all that kind of stuff. And today we are talking biodiversity loss and the potential climate challenges that's going to bring. It was very much ahead of his time. To be linked to that is quite something. But yeah, it's that we do put him in the front of our pack. He is my main logo, but yeah, his influence is perhaps limited to that. Yeah,
I take it it's not just you on the farm. You've got a team of helpful people. So do you want to kind of explain who helps you?
Yep, absolutely. So we've got 40 people working here at Mosgiel. So we've actually got 3 businesses under the Mosgiel name. We've got the dairy farm. We're milking 70 cows just now on something called a cow with calf system. So that's where we keep the cows and calves together until weaning. We're one of only 2 dairy farms in Scotland doing that. And that side of the business is really looked after by 2 fantastic women, Annika and Meg. So they look after the cows for us and do the day-to-day there. We've got 27 people who are involved in getting the milk brewed, bottled, into a van, pasteurised and out to our supporters across the UK now. And we've also got a little coffee shop. So we've got a wee coffee shop that's not on the farm. It's in a village called Stewarton. And that all came about, again, going back to my whole idea of, I felt that people had lost connection to what raw food and real food and all that kind of whole food type system was. So I wanted to sort of bring that into a cafe setting. We were supplying some of the best cafes in Scotland and I was getting lots of great ideas. And I thought we can bring organic coffee, we can bring sort of organic flour, meat, products from scratch in the back of house. We were bakers and we're in-house cooks to sort of share these whole food experiences with people. And I mean, that's been a serious challenge, especially in the current climate, but absolutely love it. So I've got another sort of, at any given time of the year, sort of 10 to 14 people running that side of the business as well. So
with all that going on, I mean, I wanted to focus on the actual dairy farm and what that involves, just to give people more understanding about that. So I know you do it a bit differently on Muskeel. So do you want to explain how maybe dairy farming has changed over the years in the UK and what's the kind of conventional way, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So this is one of the things I actually love about the dairy industry. So it's actually, you could go into two neighbouring dairy farms and the only thing that is similar between them is the fact there's cows and milk on them. They can be run completely differently. So if you go back about 100 years ago, generally the way that farming was run was every farm would have a few cows, a few sheep, some crops. They would do various different bits and bobs on it. But it was quite a mixed farming and every farm was quite a sort of, if you look across the countryside, there's a tapestry of different farms doing roughly the same thing and all working together on it. And as the sort of modern food industry has evolved, farms have become more specialised. So I'm not saying every farm's like this now, but most farms specialise in one thing. So they're generally animal farms, dairy farms, and beef and sheep's quite a common mix. And dairy farming specifically, over the past kind of 30, 40 years, the biggest thing that's happened is that something called the Milk Marketing Board was done away with. That was happening in the early 90s. That was a body set up to protect farmers' incomes. So you're protecting the price of milk. They would say to the retailers, the price of milk is X, Y, or Z, and they'd give the farmers the payment based on that. And that sort of kept a lot of farmers in business, if you like, over the years. When there was a sort of rise of the EU and deregulation in sort of 1993, roughly, that was when the Milk Marketing Board got disbanded under the monopoly rules. So it meant that there had to be more competition. But what that meant was that dairy farmers here in the UK were exposed to international quality milk prices. So instead of the milk price being protected, it was going up and down like a yo-yo depending on what happened with trading. And that was probably the single biggest shift and change for dairying over the years. And that affected farmers' incomes. And what happened was the immediate after effect was that farmers had to buy quotas. So if you had a certain amount of milk quota, that determined how much milk you could then produce. And again, that kind of protected the industry for a bit of a while. So we had this exposure to massive commodity markets, but it was protected by milk quotas because some farmers couldn't overproduce just to fund the market kind of thing. But that changed again in about 2012, I think it was, roughly, it was around about that date, where milk quotas were disbanded and dairy farmers are fully now exposed to international commodity milk prices. And that was when our farm went down. What happened was the war in Crimea had kicked off and the European Union had put sanctions on Russia, which meant that Russia then put sanctions on us and said they wouldn't buy any dairy products from the EU. At the same time, China stopped buying milk powder, so there was a big flood of milk. Our price collapsed and we were bankrupted. And that volatility has now stayed. It's just we're going through another period of low prices just now and a lot of farmers are facing basically going out of business. So because of that change, farmers have had to adopt a sort of really high efficiency mindset. So they've had to be really, really efficient with what they do. And that sort of fractured the industry kind of into two sectors. There's been a sort of very high input, housed all year round system where dairy cows are kept inside all year round. They're fed a very specific diet. They're treated like athletes in their nutrition. And they pump, because of that, they pump out an awful lot of milk. That's sort of one way that it works. Very controlled. I'm not saying it's easy to do, but it's very controlled, high welfare. That's just how it works. The opposite side is a grass-based system. So that's where the cows will go outside to grass. They'll eat grass as a majority of their diet and you'll get fluctuations in their supply throughout the year. So it's a bit less sort of controlled absolutely because the weather can contribute to it and things like that. And within that system, that grass-based system, the sort of subset of that is organic. That's where sort of cows are grazing as often as weather allows. We don't use any chemicals or fertilisers on the land and a sort of an organic farming in a nutshell. There's more to it than that, but that's it in a nutshell, sort of protecting biodiversity in that manner. So that's the kind of three main ways that farming is going down nowadays. So conventionally, you've got housed or grazed outside, and then you've got the organic, which is a kind of subset of grazing.
So, I mean, the way that you do it, you have cows with calves, so that the calves stay with the cows longer, and that's, I believe, different to the more conventional way. Can you explain about that and why that is?
So the conventional method in dairy farming is a system called snatch calving. And what that means is, as soon as the calf's born, the calves take it away to be put into a pen itself. and the cow goes and joins the herd and gets milked, and that's kind of how it operates. Now, inherently, to someone who's not involved in dairy farming, that sounds inherently cruel, and you want nobody high welfare. However, there's a little bit more to it than that. So over the years, dairy farming has evolved and cows have evolved. Disease has also evolved as well. So, for example, calves are born without any immune system. So that's very susceptible to picking up any disease. And of course, cows are dirty. The sheds are dirty. It's not a fantastic environment to be born in. It's not in the maternity ward. So in part, removing the calf immediately and then being able to ensure that it gets enough colostrum, so that's the first milk of the mother, goes into the calf. That gives it its immune system because it's getting the immunity from its mother's milk. The farmer can then make sure that it's clean, it's safe, it's in a pen, and it's not going to get harmed in any way. So that is the main reason it's done. The secondary reason is that calves will drink a significant amount of milk from a cow. So that's the sort of economic reason as well. So it's a double thing. It's not just that farmers want to make more money. There is a couple of reasons behind it. The cow-calf system, where that changes is that it's a sort of more of a focus on trying to allow the natural behaviour of the cow and calf to come through. So although we still have the same challenges around disease and injury control, which we've got to be able to, we've just basically got to adapt our management of the cows to take that into consideration, then the whole idea is about allowing the calf and cow to create a bond with each other, which is very strong, the calf to suckle naturally from the cow, and then we've got to then manage differently because effectively we're losing a significant amount of milk from that cow and putting extra labour costs in as well, so we have to charge more for the milk. So on one flip side, it makes the milk rather costly to make, which means it's higher price on the shelf, which we totally appreciate not everyone can afford. But on the other side, it actually is in line with plant-based milk pricing. So if you're looking at premium plant-based milks, it's roughly the same price. So it's allowing the customer to have an option of, yes, you can get dairy milk, which aligns with their values of keeping cows and calves together, and it is in the same price bracket as what you're willing to pay for plant-based milks. However, there's also the main dairy model as well, where if every single dairy farm in the UK went to that particular way, milk potentially could become unaffordable to some people. And of course, the great thing about milk, no matter how it's processed, is it is a bit of a nutritional powerhouse behind it. You can sit and argue every case back and forth the whole way. We do it because of the personal ethics we have with it, and we want to bring this product to market for people that believe the same way as we do, but we totally understand why the industry does it that way.
I've just finished a dairy report looking at the health and nutrition effects of dairy, and actually milk and dairy are, I think one glass of milk provides about a third of our calcium, over 40% of our iodine, 40% of our B2, and over 100% of our vitamin B12 daily requirements, and many other nutrients like vitamin A and phosphorus, folate, potassium, selenium, zinc, as well as high quality protein. And yeah, I could go on and on about the nutrition, but just thinking about the cows, and this might be a question other people have, but the dairy cows, they're normally the whole, is it Holstein cows? They're normally the dairy, the black and white cows.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the most sort of a common cow in the UK is the Holstein cow. That's a sort of a quite kind of big black and white cow. On our farm, we've got Ayrshire cows. So they're sort of more native to the area. So Robert Burns' mother had Ayrshire cows, and she used to make cheese from them because Ayrshire cows have slightly higher protein and slightly higher fats than Holstein cows. So they make a fantastic cheese because their milk's very balanced and rather high in protein. So that's why we love working with Ayrshires. The other three farms that are in the sort of group that we work with, they're a sort of mixture of Ayrshires, Holsteins, Frisians, and a couple of Jerseys in there, I think, as well. So.
And you work with, am I right in saying, a kind of cooperative of organic farms that you work with to meet now the growing demand for Mosgiel milk? Are they throughout Scotland?
Yeah, the way they've grown the business is we worked very closely with a fantastic cooperative called Organic Herd, very well with them, and they were all based in Dumfries. Recently, however, just in the past 3 or 4 weeks, we discovered that 3 organic farms up in Aberdeen had been given notice by their milk buyer, and because of where they were, no other milk company was going to take them on, and there was a very real risk that they're basically not going to be able to continue dairying. And I felt very strong that we could do something with them, so we worked with the cooperative and said, look, we're not going to buy your milk anymore. We're going to work with these 3 farms to try and work closely with them, sort of work together as a collaboration to try and sort of keep them farming. And that was what we did. As of the sort of last week in March there, we've been able to work with these 3 organic farms directly in Scotland. It was a big moment for us. So it sounds pretty simple, just buying milk from someone, but buying milk, raw milk from farms in Scotland is a very heavily regulated system. You've got lots of certifications to go through. You've got lots of cost involved as well. So it was an absolutely enormous thing for us to be able to do that. But the great thing is we've got some fantastic relationships there. You know, we're now working directly with 3 farmers who we're all on the same mission of let's see if we can make organic milk work in Scotland. Let's tell the story of organic milk and let's make this really fantastic product and share it with people. That's the whole sort of idea that we want to do.
And with the milk itself, so what actually happens with the milk? So you say, I mean, it's not raw milk because in Scotland that is, as you say, it's banned in Scotland.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So as I say, when I started the business, I really did want to sell raw milk. To be fair, I was probably a little bit arrogant towards the risks of it because I grew up on the farm. I drank raw milk every day of my life. However, after I learned a bit more about it and realised that I couldn't even sell it as bath milk, I was like, right, okay, I better look into this a bit further. When I started looking into it, there are very real reasons why we pasteurise milk in Scotland. I think at one time we had perhaps the highest rate of E. coli infections in Europe at one time. So there was a legitimate reason, and that's there. So what I wanted to do is have the next best thing. And the next best thing I felt was low temperature pasteurised milk. That was what we did. So that's effectively heating milk up to 63 degrees for half an hour. Whereas the larger dairies, the efficient high temperature way of doing it is a minimum of 73 degrees for 15 seconds. And I sort of went, right, okay, we'll do this 63 degrees. Didn't think much of it until I found out how costly it was to actually brew it at that temperature. And I thought, it's cost an absolute fortune in electricity to pasteurise it. So I sort of got the calculations out that I could find on all the studies about how you pasteurise milk for certain times and temperatures to kill bacteria. So I realised there's a way to be able to heat it up, hold it at that temperature and cool it down quickly. It was relatively energy efficient, but then I could recover that energy from that sort of batch and reuse it the next batch, and then that would then cut my costs over in batches to be able to almost match the energy efficiency of the 72 degrees but still have a low temperature pasteurised taste like raw milk. Where the absolute eureka moment came for us that I didn't see coming was that I took some milk up to a coffee shop in Glasgow who had requested some samples because they said that they wanted to buy milk direct from a farm, and they took it up and they said they couldn't believe how well this milk steamed for the specialty coffee. So they basically steamed this, made the latte art, and the latte art held really, really well. And the mouthfeel was completely different to supermarket milk. It just sort of, it really worked with the coffee and created this sort of really, like really nice coffee kind of thing. And then it started getting really popular in Glasgow around about coffee shops. I think they started supplying about 100 within a year. So it was a really fast sort of transition for us. But then when I started really thinking, there must be some reason why this milk is performing better in coffee than the competitive products. And when I started really digging into it, I found that protein within milk begins to get destabilized over sort of 68 to 69 degrees. It starts sort of being denatured and sort of damaging itself in some way. And the fat itself, the cooler you pasteurize fat, the less damaged it becomes as well. So although fat can take a lot of heat, it does get damaged in the process. And what we'd realized was because of the way we were pumping the milk, it wasn't damaging the milk on the way into the pasteurizer or out of it. And then because we weren't heating it up too high, we weren't damaging the proteins and the fats within it. And then that was when it started really getting interesting about why, how is this affecting things? At the same time as this was happening, we got a lot of feedback from people who had said, this tastes like milk from my childhood. They remembered, you know, raw milk from perhaps the 70s or 80s. But more importantly for me was there was people who had said they hadn't drank milk for years because it started not agreeing with them when they got into their sort of late 20s and early 30s. But now they were drinking gallons of the stuff from us, but they still couldn't drink it from a supermarket. And that was the thing that I really started becoming interested in, is why is the way we are processing the milk so different that actually it might be in some way affecting human health in a positive way for certain people? I'm not saying everyone, but for certain people that have some sort of sensitivity. So we did do a little bit of research into it. Now, unfortunately, we're not a big enough company to go and start doing human clinical trials on a massive basis. But in a lot of the studies that we've found, we've sort of realised that there's a potential that homogenised milk done at a certain temperature might be going through people's gut walls too quickly. So the proteins might be going through people's gut walls too quickly. Now, I must state this is a hypothesis. I'm not sitting here. But the fact that sort of loose sort of study exists and people are actually interested in looking into it, and we're seeing feedback like that, I found it really, really interesting. So that in the future, that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to find a way of being able to prove or disprove that sort of theory that's out there on that basis, because it is genuine feedback that people are actually coming back to us and telling us this.
Actually, one of the fascinating things I found from doing this dairy report as well was looking at the dairy matrix, and it's not just the individual nutrients in milk that are beneficial. It's the way that they're combined with each other and the structure of the cells and the cell walls and the milk fat globules and how they all interact with each other. And that the dairy matrix kind of impacts how nutrients are absorbed and digested and how long it stays in your stomach for. And raw milk, going back to that, I think there is some, it's often promoted as being slightly better in terms of nutrition, and because it's got live bacteria or the enzymes are not destroyed by pasteurization. But I think the evidence shows it's not anything significantly different. It does slightly reduce some of the water-soluble vitamins, I think, but not anywhere near anything notable or significant. It is done for safety reasons, as you say, and to avoid kind of harmful bacteria like E. coli and salmonella and things like that. So it's definitely a needed, useful process for food safety. But yeah, maybe the homogenization, because most supermarket milks are homogenized, which means that it doesn't separate. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So all supermarket milk in the UK goes through two processes. So the first one, it goes through the standardization and separation. And what that means is that when milk comes out of a cow, it will generally come out of a cow between sort of 3.8 and 5% fat, depending on the breed of the cow. You get some even extremes, but that's the kind of rough range. So when it goes into a dairy, to take away that sort of range of different fats, they'll take all of the fat out of it and they'll put the fat back into the skim milk to call it whole milk or semi-skimmed or whatever product that they want to make. Then once it's back together, they put it through something called a homogenizer, and that homogenizer effectively is a really high-powered jet, and it breaks up all the fat globules within it. So it takes, if you look at milk under a microscope, you'll see the fat is in lots of different sizes. You'll get big fat globules and small fat globules. But then when you put it through a homogenizer, you make them all the exact same size. So you make them homogenous. That's what it gets its name. What that means is that the cream doesn't separate. And when you see a supermarket bottle, no matter if it's one day or 10 days old on the shelf, it looks the exact same from top to bottom. Our product differs is that we do the pasteurization at a different temperature, yes, but we don't separate and we don't homogenize. So we only literally pasteurize the milk. We don't put it through any other processes.
It's a shame when you say, like, mention the fat. I mean, milk and dairy is often perceived to be quite full fat. It's often thought of as a full fat or high in fat, but it's definitely not. As you say, it's about 3.6 or about 4% fat, maybe, for the full fat, whole fat. So it's not, relatively speaking, it's fine. And actually the evidence shows that it's milk and dairy can be actually really useful for healthy weight maintenance, and it helps promote a feeling of fullness because of, I think, the dairy matrix staying in your stomach for longer. You get that feeling of fullness for a longer time, and also the protein and the combination of nutrients helps preserve muscle mass, and helps reduce the fat mass, and as well as all the nutrients. It can be actually a really useful food to include in the diet for managing your weight. And actually, with it, I don't know if you've heard much about the GLP-1 therapies, the weight loss medications. It's milk and dairy are actually in the nutritional guidelines for anyone who are on those GLP-1 Mounjaro or Ozempic type therapies for managing weight, as a really useful food to include because it's so nutrient dense. Can you share some of the, mentioned a few of them already, but some of the sustainable practices you've implemented, and have these been straightforward to do, like using glass bottles, for example, or electric delivery vans, I believe, and no single-use plastic?
So yeah, so big focus on sustainability in the business. As I say, the first thing was organics. It was a real interest in organics after my experience in Germany. And I'd sort of seen across the farm was sort of, it was all either green or it was broken hedges. That was the whole farm that across it. And I noticed that, like, a lot of the woodland, it was all sort of not dying away as such, but there were big gaps in it. And I thought that was the first thing that I noticed. And that's what kind of led me onto organics, because organics, it really puts a focus on biodiversity. So biodiversity being different plants and different animals in different places to sustain the ecosystem kind of thing. So when you're starting to look at biodiversity, number one, then that takes away all the tools of fertilizers, chemical sprays to try and control things like that. So that was a real interest for me. So yes, biodiversity is really important through organic agriculture and sustainability. The second thing was, as you say, the packaging. So I felt that at the time we were doing lots and lots of things to try and restore nature and to try and work with nature. And then we're putting my product into a plastic bottle, which 9 days later was in a bin. The chances at the time, I think recycling's improved a lot in the past 10 years, but at the time, the chances of that making its way into a recycling centre was less than 30%, I think. I thought, you know, what is the point in us doing all of this to put it in a plastic bottle? So we went single-use plastic free, which was probably the worst decision I've ever made in my life, because we lost half of our customers overnight. professional kitchens didn't want glass bottles in them. They found that the buckets that they replaced them with, so we use buckets now, which we wash and reuse and send it back out, they were awkward and you couldn't fit enough of them in the fridge. And then almost everything in the whole catering and hospitality industry is measured in 2 litre jugs. So if you phone up a dairy, you say, right, can I have 20 jugs today? And then trying to convert that into different 5 litre tubs or pints and all that, just every single thing we did was difficult. But we stuck at it. We won contracts after that because of a single-use plastic feed policy. So long-term, it has been great for the business. But the one thing that I'm constantly told is the business would probably be 4 times bigger if we did do single-use plastic. So it's one of those things that, yeah, it's been a very ethical and vision-led way of doing it, but it has restricted business growth, but that's just what it is. It's part of our values and part of who we are. The next thing we did was we looked at how we were heating up and brewing our milk. So at the time we were using electricity, obviously it's got a very high carbon footprint. Again, lower now because of the investment in the past 10 years, but at the time electricity was very high in carbon in Scotland. So we invested in biomass and solar technology. So now we have a biomass boiler on farm. That burns wood, but it doesn't burn the imported wood that you read in the newspapers that some of these big power stations do. So it all comes locally. We're able to burn it on farm. We generate heat from that. We wash our bottles from it. We heat the farmhouse and the office, and we pasteurise all the milk through it. The solar panels are there to charge our electric vehicles. So we do all of our deliveries during the night time. We come back, plug it in, and we can charge our electric vehicles from the solar, so we time it all for that. We also have invested heavily in heat recovery as well. Any heat that we produce, we don't just let it go to atmosphere. We try and harness it in various different stages and reuse it. So whether that's using the water that heats up the milk to do the brewing, that's then reused for washing the bottles. That's then reused for washing and sterilising the plant later on. So we do a lot of water recovery and heat recovery from that as well. And then we sort of, as we've grown the business as well, it would be very easy, very expensive, but very easy for us to go and put 100 vans on and start trying to deliver to every doorstep across the central belt. But actually chose not to do that. So initially we started sort of doing these milk runs and realising that other dairies were out delivering their products. And we thought, well, we do brewed organic milk. That's very much a niche. So we approached all these dairies and said, look, we'll make up a very small part of your business, but can you deliver our milk on our behalf? So although we had electric vehicles, the best vehicle is the one that's not in the road. So we said to them, can you deliver our product? They did that for us. So that's allowed us to sort of work with some fantastic businesses across Scotland, actually across the UK now through actually collaborating instead of competing. So it's not just about sticking up a windmill and saying, oh, we're green. It's all about saying, let's look at every single stage of a process and see where we can improve it constantly. But there's one thing in particular that I've actually been really quite proud to be able to do. And that's actually, it was really weird. Going to all these coffee shops, you see the waste that comes out of the coffee shops, and that waste is mainly coffee grounds. And these coffee grounds are actually fantastic soil enhancers. They're amazing when you compost them. And we thought to ourselves, how can we work with the coffee community to be able to do something a bit different? So we decided that what we're going to do was compost coffee on the farm, mix it with the cow dung and the cow compost. Now we can spread it in the fields as fertiliser, an organic fertiliser because it's natural. And that was sort of pretty cool. We're taking from 2 or 3 cafes, but it wasn't really having a massive impact. And then we were contacted by Scotland's largest coffee roaster called Matthew Algae. So they generate a bit of waste every year. We thought, right, okay, like, can we be quite bold and do something? So we take all their coffee waste, we compost it on the farm, and again, we spread it. So that then grows the grass, which feeds the cow, which produces the milk, goes back to the coffee. It's a full sort of circle. What I didn't anticipate at that time was the challenge of getting something like that approved by CEPA, by the Scottish Environment Protection Agency. Because coffee is not really mixed with dairy farming very often, they didn't really have a box to tick for that one. So it took me quite a number of meetings and different things to be able to get that over the line. So we've managed to find the regulation that gets that, and we've been able to do that. But yes, that took me about 3 years to get my head around just how we would do it. But now we're doing it, it's a fantastic product for the farm.
And you do different products as well, not just milk, but I did hear a little bit, I think it was on your social media, about the chocolate milk and then the cheese as well. What have you kind of learned from that process, or how have they gone?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. The cheese hasn't launched yet. So at Christmas time, we invited, our supporters and my followers into a sort of new idea we had. The idea was that we would take cheese from before the calf was born, before the cow was milking. We would share the story of the whole system. So from the cow calving down to the milk being produced, to that milk being turned into cheese, to it being matured and then delivered to the customer. So the whole idea was a sort of experience where people can invest in a cheese and 4 or 5 months later they would get it. So we're coming to a stage now where the cows are calving and we're able to get that sort of cheese moving. So the whole idea was that people could be involved in that journey, they could learn the whole process of cheese, because cheese just doesn't appear. You don't just walk into the supermarket and buy a cheese that's made of thin air. It's a big process. So I wanted to share that, and that was something that was really exciting for us. Then after that first batch is out there, we can then talk about what we're doing next with cheese kind of thing. We've also got a butter out as well, so that's made in collaboration with a Glasgow company. So we can deliver our cream up there, and they used old-fashioned traditional churns to make the butter, so you get the full flavour of the butter through. And we also use Blackthorn salt, so that's a local salt that's made down in Ayrshire, so it's only 10 miles away from us, so we can use that. And yes, the chocolate milk is off the market right this very minute because we're doing some upgrades behind the scenes. But what we're able to do with that is we took the waste product from the chocolate making process from a company called Bare Bones Chocolate in Glasgow. So very high-end quality chocolate. We brew those waste husks, which are effectively food waste. We brew them in milk for an hour. And we then add a little bit of sugar. So that's actually not much sugar at all. I think we're adding 1.5% sugar into it. And you get this very sort of, not very many ingredients at all. Chocolate milk is very creamy and very chocolatey. So the only thing that's really in it is milk and sugar, and it's been infused with cocoa husks. And it was very, very popular. One of the challenges we found with it was that the way we designed the equipment, because it's a little bit funky in how we make it, we couldn't filter the chocolate husk properly. So we're investing in a new filtration system so that we can do it better and a bit more consistently.
Great. Well, look out for that relaunching then. Sounds good. Gosh, you're massively busy. I can't believe the amount of stuff that you've done in the last kind of 10 or so years just to build a business and be pioneers and do things a bit differently. What do you see in the future? Where would you like the dairy industry going in kind of the next couple of years or 5 years or 10 years time even?
For the industry, I would really like for farmers to get a better and a more sustainable system. I feel just now that the dairy industry has ended up with five dairies controlling 90% of the market in the UK, but I think that farmers are constantly on the rough end of the stick. I think that those who choose to invest are doing so for the right reasons. So they've been told by the milk buyers, we want more and more and more milk, and then there's too much milk. Those same farmers who have invested and taken the risk have been told, right, you're getting this amount of money for it, or you're dumping your milk. And that is happening right now. You know, it's not fantasy. There's people being told, we are not picking your milk up, just dump it because there's too much milk. So there's really no link between demand and supply. It's just a case of when the commodity market goes up, you produce more milk. Commodity market drops, you dump your milk, and whoever doesn't survive, that's fine, because the next people will be bigger and they'll do it again. But where I want to see is for more small farms to be given the option of being able to do something. And that was really why we exist today. And I made a decision 7 years ago that we weren't just going to be one small farm producing a small market. We wanted to support other farmers. And the way that we're doing that, yes, when milk is more expensive, and that is bought by people who can't afford it, but we're being supported through our business to support small-scale farms with a product that's very high quality. And that's what I want to see is going. I don't want the dairy industry to be a faceless industry controlled by the minimum of companies. I want people to have fair prices, people to get a great product on the supermarket shelf, and everything in between to be full of fairness and transparency. I don't think that's the way it's grown for the past 30 years. I think that's been a massive mistake of the industry's part. So where I want to be is I want to have a business that shows there is a different way to do dairy, that we have these sort of very natural products. We want them to be the products of 100 years ago, but affordable, and let people taste what the real dairy products are without any sort of additives, fillers or preservatives in them. And yeah, that's going to have its challenges of shelf life, and it's going to have its challenges of consistency, but it's where we want to go as a business, and I think that there's an opportunity there for us.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, one of the key things there for me was the taste, because, I mean, as you said before, people recognise or reminisce about how milk used to taste back in the kind of school days when we used to have bottles of milk for free at primary school. I remember those days, but it tasted different then to what it does now. And yeah, I think your milk certainly does taste very flavoursome and has a different mouthfeel to the supermarket milk. So what would you, just to finish off, I mean, it's been a fascinating conversation, to finish off, what would you say has been kind of your tastiest food or meal in the past couple of weeks? Has there been anything stand out, just as a final question?
The best food I had in the past few weeks was at the Glasgow Coffee Festival at the weekend there. Nothing to do with dairy. I met one of my sort of food heroes, if you like, and it was the guys behind Company Bakery in Edinburgh, and they had a full range of bakery products. And I don't even know what it is just now, but they had this sort of seeded loaf and it was absolutely fantastic. It was probably the best I had in my life. So I've eaten the full thing in 2 days. So it's probably not very good for my health. But
it was during COVID, I think, that I found a bakery that was supplying company bakery bread. It was a sourdough wholemeal seeded. It might have been the same one that you tried. And honestly, that was the best thing through COVID that I ever ate. And yeah, it was so glad that I found their bakery because they do amazing bread. There's lots of great bakeries. But yeah, well, thank you so much for all that information. It's been a great insight just to hear more about dairy farming and different ways of doing dairy and all the sustainability actions that you've been doing and innovations and collaborations that you've been doing. So really interested to see what happens in the next few weeks, months, years with you. And for anyone who doesn't follow you on social media, I would definitely recommend to follow you. What's your social media handle?
All of them are just Moscow Fan.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks so much for joining me today and enjoy the rest of the sunshine.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to this Food Connections podcast. If you want to find out more about the nutrition and health effects of milk and dairy, check out the recent report I helped write for the Agriculture Horticulture Development Board. The link to this report is in the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be great if you could give the podcast a rating and leave a short review. And if you know someone who might enjoy this episode, please do share it with them. Also, if you'd like to sponsor the podcast, do get in touch. My email is nutrition@laurawinus.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.